Hello, everybody. This is Storm Clouds Gathering. I'm here with James Corbett of the Corbett Report and Kevin Rose, Grounded Being, on YouTube. James Corbett is one of my favorite channels, one of the best news channels. I would say, in my opinion, the best news channel on YouTube for alternative news, if you want to hear the other side of the story. This is actually the first time to actually talk to James. I've had Skype chats with them, but this is the first time to actually connect with them digitally, voice to voice, with our electrons streaming across the ocean. So James, welcome to the Fireside Chat. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. Thank you for having me here. It's nice to cozy up with a nice warm fire right early in the morning for me.
I have a whole bunch of questions for you. I asked my my Facebook peeps questions they wanted to ask you. And, of course, there was no shortage ranging from, well, we won't get into that right away. So, in your opinion, I mean, you cover a lot of geopolitical stuff. How did you get into this particular genre? How did you start getting interested in these topics, and what was it that got you to start being active and start speaking out?
Well, for me, 9/11 was a catalyst. I had always been interested in politics, and I considered myself politically informed to some extent before I ever started the website, but I was really very much trapped in the left-right matrix. I came at it from the left side, being a good Canadian socialist, and that was basically something that filtered all of the reality that I was processing. So when 9/11 happened, I viewed it from that traditional left side of the spectrum and saw it as blowback and all of those narratives that Chomsky and others were putting out about it. And that was pretty much the way I interpreted what happened. And then around 2006, I started to encounter 9/11 truth information. And for a long time, I'd been resistant to any conspiracy theories around 9/11 because I thought, well, this is just one of those events you shouldn't really question. It was a little too raw a nerve, I suppose, for a lot of people, and myself included. And then around 2006, it was the fifth anniversary. There was a lot of motion and energy online around 9/11 truth, and I guess I got some of the reflected second wave of that motion and energy, and that kind of hit me, and I started to look into it. And the more I looked into it, the more I found that was actually sourceable and verifiable, and that I could figure out for myself that there was definitely big flaws and loopholes and missing parts of the official story. So that started getting me to look into it. And I eventually got to the point where I was pretty much convinced that there was something completely different that happened on 9/11 than what we'd been told, but I couldn't quite put that last piece into place because I was resistant to the idea itself. And that's when I came across the Money Masters, the documentary featuring Bill Still. And that was really the piece of the puzzle that I needed for it to make sense to me. Once I realized that the entire monetary system was controlled by a very few and had been for centuries, that was really what I needed to understand in order for the rest to fall into place. And from that point, it was so rapid. I mean, to looking back, it was amazing. I started encountering this in September of 2006. By early 2007, January, February, I had already decided that I wanted to set up a website. So I just I set one up, and by June of 2007, I was podcasting.
It's interesting because The Money Masters is one of those pivotal films for me as well. I remember when I watched it, the feeling was, I'd always had this sense that there was this kind of shadowy group behind the scenes. And when I saw it, I remember it was just like this eureka moment of, ah, they have names. You know, we can actually put a face on it.
They have a system. They have a way of doing this. I mean, it was just one of those things that's so fundamental to our entire society that when you finally see some of the pieces of that and what it really, where it really comes from, you start to think, well, why have I never been taught this before? Why didn't they spend, you know, one class in high school going over this instead of whatever else we were studying? I mean, it's just so basic to our lives that it was amazing to me. I'd never encountered it, but it makes sense when you realize that it is being controlled by a very few.
Yeah, it does make sense. Yeah, the educational system is one of those things that... how far would you be willing to go in terms of questioning our current system, our current paradigm of education and parenting and all of these things? Like, what kind of... when you look at the whole thing, I mean, this is kind of one of those huge questions, but what kind of... Well, I guess we should start with economic. Because I've heard you talk about economics before, because you do you did a show recently with Charlie McGrath, which we're going to have Charlie McGrath on coming on at 10 o'clock. He's currently in his own show right now. But you guys talked about economic systems, and I've been thinking a lot about economic systems lately. If you could just start with a clean slate, and you were keen for however much time it took to get this done, and then you could do whatever you want afterwards, what kind of economic system would you want?
Well, this is probably a question that's above my pay grade, but I can at least say some of the principles that I think we should adhere to when we're creating such a system, because I think that that's fundamentally what has to be down. And if you can figure out the principles, then the rest can be kind of figured out as a second level type of thing. So what I'm talking about, for example, is the principle that myself, I'm an anarchist. I know that word brings with it a lot of baggage and associations, but I fundamentally don't believe in the initiation of force or the monopoly of violence by a small group of people who wear a hat or have a badge or claim to have some sort of authority that's been magically bestowed upon them. So I think that fundamentally the initiation of force, the use of violence, or the supposed legal right of some to initiate force or violence on others shouldn't exist in any society. And I think it's important to understand how basically, I mean, central banking and the centralized control of the money supply and the enforcement of legal monopoly on certain types of money is itself a type of force and violence, and can be used to commit fraud and to basically defraud people of their life savings, etc. As we've seen, for example, with the inflation tax in the Federal Reserve System in the United States. And so I think fundamentally one of the principles that we should be adhering to is that this should not be something, money, whatever it is, or however we choose to organize it, should not be something that is controlled by a very few people who make decisions in some board meeting in some room somewhere. It should be something that is, if not decentralized, perhaps at least transparent, completely transparent, as, for example, in some type of LET system, community-based local exchange trading system, something like that. I think that's more the basis of what I'd like to see the economy built around, rather than some piece of paper that's somehow magically bestowed value because it has been made legal tender by a bunch of laws that are enforced by men with badges and guns.
Could you elaborate on the LETS system?
It is an idea for a mutual credit system whereby people basically create their own currency in that system. And basically all it is it's a way of keeping track of credit that is owed to people in the system. And what happens is, I mean, there's different ways of setting it up, but as an example, you would come into the system by creating some credit that you could then spend. And the money is in fact just representative of hours of service that you give. So everyone has their own thing that they do. Everyone has their own contribution that they can make. So that, for example, if you need some carpentry done, you can pay for that carpentry by paying into the system by creating credit by whatever it is that you do. Maybe you're a house painter or whatever. So you paint a house, it takes X number of hours, you get X number of hours to spend into that system, and you can collect that from different people with whatever they have. So that's an idea for a locally based alternative currency system, or it at least a complementary currency system. And I think it's important to understand the differences between those, because alternative currency means something that's going to replace the Federal Reserve dollars that you have in your pocket or whatever, whereas a complementary currency is something that can be used in addition to the other currencies that are floating around. And fundamentally, I think at the end of the day, the real solution is probably not going to be one system for everyone that's used in every transaction. I think it's going to be a number of different systems that are used in different transactions. So I'm a big fan of the idea of complementary currencies, and a locally based LET system would be one way of facilitating local trade, which I think would only be for the good of the community.
Someone wanted me to ask you specifically about Bitcoins, and that kind of segues right in right there. What are your thoughts on Bitcoin?
It does, doesn't it? Well, I am conflicted about Bitcoin. I'm not a big proponent, but I'm not an opponent either. And I know that's a wishy-washy answer, but I think that right now, for example, the incredible run-up we've seen in the last week or two in the price of Bitcoin, to me, it's just speculative. This is not anything fundamentally due to the nature of the currency or its utility at this point in time that is running up the price right now. Fundamentally, what we're seeing is a run-up based on speculation, and to a certain extent, that's a credit to the Bitcoin that it has been, I suppose, stable enough that it is now being looked at as an investment opportunity for some, but there's still not enough underlying it to justify the value. I think that the idea of Bitcoin does have a place, a role that it can play in society, especially as more and more is being done online, transacted online. And it at least offers the theoretical possibility, perhaps, if you know what you're doing, to maybe make it anonymous. But I don't really trust online anonymity in any way, shape, or form. So I think that that's a bit of a pipe dream. But at the very least, I think it is one good idea for transacting online in a way that circumvents the national currencies and the control of the central banks. That's always for the good. And it is a good way of doing those types of transactions. But at the moment, at any rate, its utility in day-to-day transactions is nowhere near the place where it would need to be to justify the $60 a Bitcoin or whatever the rate is today. So I think that it's a bit getting out of control. I think people are a little too interested at the moment. But as an idea, as something that can be used to help facilitate certain online transactions, I think it's a good idea. And again, another one of those currencies that we can throw into the complementary currency mix that will be just one of many different options that I hope will be available to people when they're deciding, you know, how to pay for each different transaction.
Wow, that's crazy. Just $60. Someone gave me a Bitcoin like 2 years ago. I still have it because I haven't been able to figure out how to spend it. So it went from 30 to 15 and now it's 60. Wow, that's a huge move.
I might be making that number up. The last time I actually checked, it was 40, but I heard it went up to 60. I haven't been checking on a day-to-day basis, but it has been running up a huge amount in the last few weeks.
Speaking of speculation, some people asked what are your thoughts in terms of investment? Do you invest? And I would actually wanted to put it a little deeper, just the concept of investment, you know, making money off the movement of money. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, well, there are ethical issues there, aren't there? Let's put it this way. I've never had a lot of money to play around with. So in terms of that, I don't have a lot to invest, even if I wanted to. So far at this point, basically with long-term savings, I've been putting them into precious metals because precious metals have retained their values for literally thousands of years and presumably always will. So for those savings that you want to keep for that rainy day 50 years down the road or whatever that may be, I think that's the safest possible place you can put it. But in terms of when you have money to actually invest, I mean, it is a question that it reflects on so much of our values. I mean, it really is putting your money where your mouth is when it comes to that, because you can make money investing in the system as it exists. I mean, there is money to be made, and although we know that there is mathematically a collapse coming, we don't know exactly when that's going to be, and we don't know how it's going to occur. And in the meantime, at any rate, there is money to be made in the run-ups and even the rundowns of the market, depending how you invest, whether you invest in derivatives and that sort of financial instrument. So, I mean, let's put it this way. If you wanted to make money, you probably couldn't go wrong if you invest in stocks of defense corporations, because they're always in business and they're always having booming trades. So it's probably a good idea if you want just to make money, but obviously that isn't the point for myself, and I would hope not for a lot of people out there, that it's simply about the pursuit of the money. I think it should also be thought of as how we can invest in the infrastructure of our communities, how we can invest in the development of those around us. And clearly that isn't going to come from investing in companies, in big multinational corporations of any stripe or variety, let alone defense contractors. So I think, I mean, there is a value to a stock market. That is a valuable idea in a real free market, and in something that isn't controlled and run through this fiat currency that's created by the central bank and all of the fraud and manipulation based on that. But just as the system exists, I couldn't ever imagine myself investing in a stock or a hedge fund or anything of that sort in this system. So that's what I do. What other people choose to do, I'm not particularly concerned about. But I don't think... I think we should at the very least be smart about our money and realize that when we spend money, I mean, we really are voting with our dollars and with our time and energy and everything that money represents into how we want the community and the around us to proceed in the future. I mean, it's basically like a vote that we use every day. And unlike the vote that comes around once every 4 years, this one actually has meaning. It actually produces real changes in the society around us. So I think when it comes to investing, again, I just hope that people are at least thinking about what that money is doing, because, again, money should be used for something rather than just sitting there in the ground, although we do need some of that stored away for the rainy day. But I think the idea of using it to actually create or do something is a good idea. I just think within the system that we have right now, I can't really see a good investment in the sense that I think we would want.
Yeah, those are good points.
I've got a question. How do you see, James, the mathematical certainty of whatever you want to call it, whether you collapse, whatever the terminology is, how do you see that playing out? I mean, we look at what's going on in Cyprus right now, the obvious, but just from your opinion, how do you see that happening?
It's difficult to answer that because there are so many different ways it could happen. I would answer, if I'm going to answer that from the perspective of if I was in charge and pulling the strings and could perfectly control the system, what would I do?
Right.
And I think that the probably one of the most effective ways would to be to have a sudden sharp collapse of the system a la Cyprus, but to have that not just in one small area, but to have that across the board, say a collapse of the euro that facilitates a collapse of the dollar, something like that. If that were to happen relatively suddenly and the banks went on holiday, they would and could and presumably will just go behind the scenes, have their Bretton Woods 3 or whatever they want to have, and come out with the new international standard, and they could literally re-engineer the entire international financial structure overnight, because it is something that came about basically through a process of crisis. I mean, we have to understand that the current system was based on the Bretton Woods conference that was held in 1944 in New Hampshire in World War II, and it was basically the Allied countries getting together and deciding how to arrange the entire infrastructure for the world, the financial infrastructure for the entire world, after they got done bombing the hell out of Germany and Japan. So I think we have to understand that that's an extremely effective tool, and it's been used in the past, basically the crisis scenario. But there's also the long, slow burn scenario, where it's just slowly evaporating away the savings and the wealth of a vast number of people. And at a certain point, that becomes... it becomes more of a transitionary type of thing, where people just start to transition into whatever new system is offered. I think the sudden collapse scenario is probably more effective, because there's not a lot people can do at that point unless they are prepared and independent. And I think we can probably all agree not many people are prepared for that type of collapse scenario at this point.
Right.
You know, this brings me to an interesting question, which probably will segue into a whole bunch of other topics. This conjunction of war with the financial collapse that we're seeing, How do you see that playing out? Like the World War III kind of scenario we're seeing build up toward, you know, in Syria and Iran and in Africa.
Well, exactly right. Well, I mean, war and financial collapses go hand in hand and always have. And again, I mean, people point to the Great Depression as the example of, and it was saved through World War II. So that's one classic example. And it happens time and again when there is this type of economic collapse for a number of reasons, but I think not necessarily for that semi-altruistic reason that they want to get the economy going again so that people can benefit, so much as they want a boogeyman to blame the economic collapse on. Because if you can blame it on, oh, it was, you know, it was that attack that we had that ended up collapsing the dollar, then that shunts the blame. And if you can shunt the blame for what happened off onto some imaginary boogeyman, then obviously you never have to confront the fact that it was these people in these positions of power who were self-knowingly, I mean, completely understandingly, they set up what happened and they knew what was happening. If they can just create a boogeyman, then they never have to really confront that fact. So I think probably in our context, the most likely way that will play out, I think this is more of a long war scenario, and I'm thinking not anytime in the near future, but the end game of this clearly right now is the encirclement of Russia and China. And I think that's ultimately where this is heading. And I'm not sure exactly what pieces of the puzzle will come together to make that happen. I mean, Syria leading to Iran seems like a logical point at this point, a logical path for that aggression to follow. And that would almost certainly kick off some sort of aggression. I mean, Russia would almost certainly be ready to respond at that point. And I'm sure China could be goaded if there was some sort of bigger conflict there. But then you have other wild curveballs, like what's happening on the Korean Peninsula right now with North Korea abrogating the armistice. So that's going to create a whole different situation there that could potentially ignite some other type of spark. Japan and China tensions have been raising. There could be something completely off the radar that happens, perhaps something in Africa that eventually puts China head-to-head with the U.S. in some sort of proxy war or something. I mean, who knows how it'll kick off, but I imagine that ultimately it's going to be about that. I mean, that's the core kernel of what we can see developing in whatever type of World War III scenario develops. But at this point, I mean, as impressive, I suppose, if you want to use that word, as the Chinese Navy is becoming, for example, with some of their developing technologies and Russia reinvesting in some of its military infrastructure, it's still anywhere even close to being able to put up a fight with the U.S. and the NATO allies. So I think, because I think this is mostly crafted and manipulated and staged, I think that this is probably just going to be drawn out for a number of years until such point as some sort of acceptable-looking type of conflict can happen. But again, I'm very skeptical about all of this, and I think really that this is more stage theater than it is actual conflict, because I think the people at the very, very top of all of these structures are just puppeteering it. I don't think it has anything to do about real genuine aggression between, say, America and China or anything of the sort, because self-evidently the oligarchs in the U.S. have been setting up China as the place for manufacturing to be offshore to for the past decade or two, and that has been done self-evidently and deliberately through a series of trade deals that can be traced back, and we know this has been happening. So I think that the idea that there's really some genuine aggression between these two parties is mostly just optics.
Your perception of the Korean situation is unfolding. Do you see, is there something about this whole scenario that's going down that the public is not seeing? If there was, you know, saying, just pretending that the audience here is just mainstream, they've just been listening to the mainstream news. Is there something about this that people should know?
My take on it is that everyone benefits from this destabilization that's going on right now, because everyone wants a little piece of what's happening right now. North Korea obviously just wants attention, because they've used this as a bargaining strategy basically for years now, going back to when they first decided to abrogate the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and start their nuclear program. And ever since then, they've been using these types of scare scenarios and nuclear tests and all of these types of things to draw people to the table so that they can get goodies in various forms, and then to abrogate those deals and to continue ahead. And that's basically what they've been doing for a decade now. So I think it benefits them to start kicking up the dust and making waves. It benefits the U.S. side and all of their proxies in the region, including Japan, because it provides the excuse for what they've already decided to start doing, which is the Asia-Pacific pivot, to start pumping money into the armed forces over here and to start building that up. And, of course, the defense contractors obviously stand to reap billions, literally billions of dollars from this Asia-Pacific pivot. So if they have a boogeyman to scare people with, then that helps make that process of selling that technology all that much more easier. And I, in a certain way, I mean, I'm not sure if China really sees anything good coming out of this, because they are basically keeping North Korea on a lifeline. Without China's economic support, North Korea wouldn't be able to survive at all, and the regime would collapse probably overnight. So they are basically attempting, I mean, in some ways it does work out for them, because they get to be seen as the ones who can keep North Korea in some sort of control. They're the ultimate puppet masters, because if they remove their support, North Korea will collapse. So in a way they can be seen to have control over the situation, and that makes them a stronger partner in all of this, because then we have to take them seriously when they come to the table with various proposals. So in a way they get something out of it too. South Korea, it's difficult to see if they get anything other than a madman on their doorstep. And I really think this is kind of the madman scenario. I think North Korea really is a curveball, and there's just not a lot that can be predicted about what's coming out of there. I don't think they're actually going to use any of their nuclear firecrackers, basically. I mean, they're half the size of what was used in Hiroshima, even. They're not particularly sophisticated weapons. But I can't even imagine them trying to use one against South Korea, for example. I just don't see that as a likely possibility. But again, you never know, and I suppose it is possible. But I don't think that really benefits South Korea. But other than that, I think pretty much everyone in the area has something to gain from this. And in fact, South Korea did just recently sign a $2 billion deal for some drones to police the demilitarized zone. So again, I guess the defense contractors make out like bandits from all of it.
I've got a tangent question, if I can. Just I'm really curious, and this is, sorry to be peppering you with different questions left and right, but I'm really curious about the Fukushima situation. I mean, I'm sure you've been asked a million times, but what are the health factors surrounding the area? I mean, what's happening right now? Because you know, you can get reports about it, but I don't know if you have any more access to the truth than we do. But you know, what do you know about that?
Well, I mean, it's the difficult thing, because the effects, obviously, of radiation exposure, especially not when we're not talking high-level radiation exposure that's going to kill you in a matter of days, when we're talking about low-level radiation exposure that will kill you over the course of 20 years or whatever it is, I mean, it's exceptionally difficult to really pinpoint what the real health risks are, and we won't be able to really quantify that in any way for at the very least several more years. And by that point, of course, there's all the different factors that come into differentiating. Well, I mean, there's no way to tell whether this cancer developed just naturally or as a result of the radiation. There are different statistical methods that can be used, but of course it depends what control samples you use and all of that, so it can be fudged just like any other statistical data. So I think it's one of those things where I don't want to just throw up my hands and say we'll never know, but perhaps we will never know. I mean, it's one of those types of scenarios, but I think it's very telling that in the last several months, not only have the authorities and the various mouthpieces for government power that you would expect to come out with the types of pronouncements that basically cover what the government and its allies in the big corporations are doing, have been saying, not only have they been saying that this hasn't posed a real health risk to anyone, but they've also come out recently with the idea that now it's the psychosomatic factor, being scared of the radiation, is probably the biggest health risk of Fukushima. And that, to me, is a particularly pernicious lie, because basically that's saying that oh, don't listen to the crazy people who care about radiation leaking into the environment. They are so crazy, they are the ones who are making you sick. So this is, of course, an attempt to basically get people not only to shut up and fall into line with the official line that this isn't a big problem, but then to also demonize the people who are actually attempting to do work on this. And I mean, we can say, for example, that that several children in the Fukushima area have been diagnosed with thyroid cancer. But again, it's only been 2 years now, so I think that even that is probably too early to be able to say whether or not that came from Fukushima, or is this is part of a trend that's going to increase. Again, it's just too early to say in a lot of different respects. But I think the idea that this is all just psychosomatic stress, and oh, maybe the thyroid cancer was psychosomatic as well, is not just wrong, but it's painfully wrong. I mean, it's a disservice to everyone, and is a transparent attempt to try to shut people up on the issue.
And what are they saying about the containment of it? I mean, what's the line about the containment?
Well, the official line is cold shutdown. So in December 2011, they said, well, look, the water isn't boiling off anymore. It's under 100 degrees. It's in cold shutdown. It's stable. Basically, we can go away and not think about it anymore. But the fundamental point is that the corium, the stuff that was in the core, they still don't know exactly where it is. They don't know exactly where the containment, they believe that it got within a few inches of the bottom of the containment in some of the reactors, but they still don't know all of the details of the corium. They still obviously can't get in to actually check it, and the best they can do is send in probes that can kind of look around and see what's happening in there, but even that is a flawed technology at best. And we do know that there are leaks and cracks in the containment, and this is creating water that runs off that they're collecting, and they have to put more water in. And they are starting to run out of storage space for this water, and the idea has been floated that they will simply dump the water out into the ocean directly because they just don't have any more room to store it. This is just an absolutely horrific situation, but of course, the media is not covering that side of it. Right. It really was in December 2011. They said cold shutdown, so the media just basically shut down and fell into line with that. So I think that's something that we have to continue to keep our eye on, as well as the spent fuel pool in Reactor 4, which was contained above ground and is in a building which itself is a listing and is potentially could collapse at any moment. And if that collapses, there are over 1,500 fuel rods in that spent fuel pool that would then be exposed into the environment, which would be even bigger than Chernobyl. That would be a scenario that would be absolutely nightmarish in proportions. And they've done some testing to test what it would be like to take some of those spent fuel rods out of the pool. And I think they took two of the rods out of the 1,500 plus that are there. And I guess the actual operation to start really removing them in earnest is going to begin this December. So until then, and until they're all removed, basically the world is at hostage to this crisis that's there that again, no one's really talking about. But if the building collapses, I think all bets are off the table, and bye-bye Northern Hemisphere to a certain extent.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at the flow of the currents, too, I mean, that's it. I mean, once it's in the ocean, and that was my question about, you know, how do they have readings? Are they even talking about readings in the ocean? What are we seeing? I don't know how quickly that material travels or, you know, how viscous it is, but I was just curious about what the word is.
Right. Well, some of the debris actually started washing up on the shores of North America last year. And and we do know, for example, they continue to take readings of fish that are fished in the Fukushima area. And it seems like every week there's a new story about record levels of radiation being found in some of the fish there. And yet, fish that are fished from the Fukushima area are available in Tokyo fish markets. So it just goes to show that the stamp of government approval can seem to placate a number of people. Well, at least they won't be psychosomatically stressed by all of this and be worrying themselves sick, because it's being sold in the Tokyo fish markets. It must be safe.
Oh, wow. That's intense. Thank you.
You're welcome. And let me just say, I mean, as someone who lives here in Japan, I live about 450 miles from Fukushima, so it is far enough that the fallout wasn't the main concern for us, but it is a concern about the seafood, because obviously that affects the entire Pacific side of Japan. So basically my wife and I aren't eating seafood anymore, which and won't be for the conceivable next 10,000 years or so. So it is it's an incredible thing that I don't know if the Japanese people have processed this really, what this really means for what's happened to their country, but it is a horrific thing to contemplate that basically we have to distrust everything that's coming from that Pacific side for the conceivable future.
Go ahead, Aaron.
No, I don't. If you had another question related to that topic, we can.
No, I would just, as you were talking about the seafood, I was just, you know, I was just thinking about too, you know, any land animal, whatever food source you have in the area, I mean, it would also be contaminated, obviously. So, yeah, that's interesting. Sorry, go ahead, Aaron.
No, there was a person who had asked a question, and they directed it towards me, but I don't have any real answer for it. It's Kylo Wierick in the comments. He asked if I had any insight, or if any of us had any insight on the recent trade pact with Brazil, Russia, China, India, South Africa, basically the BRICS countries.
Right. Yeah. No, I hope people are following this. The BRICS are meeting right now in Durban, South Africa. And there's a number of things that are on the agenda for this meeting. I haven't actually checked. I just woke up recently, so I haven't checked what the latest from the summit is. But one of the things that is on the agenda is to address the idea of the development bank. So last year in India at their fourth summit, they came out with the proposal that they were going to work on the creation of a development bank to be a complement to the IMF World Bank structure. And it's whatever they come out with is likely going to be extremely humble at first. The idea that's been floated around is that they're going to capitalize it with $50 billion. That's $10 billion from each of the five BRICS to start with. But this is, I mean, a potentially very revolutionary idea in terms of what's happening on the geopolitical stage, because Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, depending how they decide to capitalize it and how they decide to actually set up the bank itself. For example, if it makes it, I mean, this would basically be something that would invest in infrastructure development projects in different countries, not only within the BRICS zone, but presumably in other parts of Africa and other places besides. But this could be a way, for example, for China to invest in the infrastructure and development of India, and which could then become one of the larger, probably the largest trading partner of China in the future if they can get those types of projects going. So it is, it has the potential to be a truly revolutionary idea. And if those loans from that development bank are made in, for example, in yuan instead of dollars, you really are starting to see the building blocks of an alternative to the dollar, petrodollar world reserve currency starting to be laid with something like that. So this is potentially a very huge thing. I mean, I have no doubts that there will be all sorts of corruption and ridiculousness that go on as within any type of international structure like this. But at any rate, it is something that I think people should keep their eye on from the perspective of this has the potential to be that one of those catalyzing events towards the complete removal of the dollar from its place of world hegemon. So, I mean, it's quite an interesting development. And so I believe that they've just kicked off the summit, and it'll be going for today and tomorrow. So I hope people will keep their eyes on the news feeds for that, because there will be some interesting things coming out of that summit, I think.
I had a question about your thoughts on these economic blocks that we see springing up. I mean, you saw Venezuela was trying to organize in South America, and you see Africa organizing their own blocks, and obviously you have the European Union. And, you know, one hand, this is all presented in terms of competition with the dollar. But I wonder what your perspective is on whether this is actually really competition or more unifying these people into blocks, thinking that they're competing with the dollar only to have them easier to unify into the next currency.
I think that's self-evidently, for example, what the entire Eurozone has been about. The entire Euro project has been about and has been sold to the public as the creation of this economic currency block that will have the ability to compete with the dollar, blah, blah, blah. But I think we all understand where that's heading, because if, for example, the euro actually worked, which it didn't, and I think it's going to fail at some point. But if that idea works, then it can be pitted in a type of dialectic against the dollar. Oh, well, we need a regional currency block. And of course, it is just the stepping stones towards the creation of that world government. So I think exactly right. We do have to be suspicious of these trends. And that's exactly why I think it's important to steer the conversation towards the idea of complementary currencies and other ways to detach ourselves from the dollars or the yen or the pesos or the euros or whatever it is that constitute our day-to-day money. Because at the end of the day, that money is controlled by central banks and central banksters. And we do not exert any control over it. Whereas the types of complementary currencies that could be made, the time banking, the mutual credit systems, all of those ideas, even things like Bitcoin, are not controlled by states. They are controlled more or less either by people or by algorithms or there are different ways of setting it up. But I think to remove that control from the banksters has to be the main point. And when you look back at American history as one example, I mean, you can clearly see that the history of America has been the history of the struggle against the central bankers. And they won in 1913. And unfortunately, from that point, they use their power and privilege in society to leverage and manipulate the education system to drum out the education about this history and the economic struggle that's been waged in the U.S. so that for the last 100 years, their victory has been total. 110 years ago, one of the hottest issues that existed was the should we have a central bank? Should we have bimetallism? What kind of currency should we use? How should we back it up? These were hot button political issues. Whereas until very, very recently, I mean, even the name, the Federal Reserve, didn't even mean anything to most people. So in the last several years, we have seen that truly revolutionary moment where people are starting to once again think about these issues. But unfortunately, still not a lot of people really understand the significance of this. So I think that's one thing that is a potential bright spot from this economic disturbance, because in times of destabilization, people are at least open to new ideas and open to exploring the system and how it came to be and why it exists the way it does and who it benefits. So it is a point where if we are loud enough and strong enough and make our point clearly enough, then we can convince other people that there are valid reasons to maybe not trust these big regional currency blocks as the savior to humanity and start looking at other solutions. So, I mean, that's at least one potential positive that can develop from this.
Which brings me to another question I wanted to ask you, which is about your perception of the state of the awakening, how you see it in its current state right now, where you think people are at, and particularly your perception of the difference of the consciousness in Japan versus people in Canada versus the United States, because that's one thing that I think a lot of times people, when they're within their own country, they have a hard time understanding. That until you get out of your country, you can't really see past certain assumptions.
That is true, and certainly there are differences. But I suppose maybe I'm skewed because I spend a lot of my time online and communicating in online ways. But I mean, that in and of itself is, I think, significant because I think there is a large proportion and large percentage of, at the very least, the younger generations, I'm not sure I'm really in that category anymore, but people under 40, we'll say, who really have spent a lot of their life connected to people around the globe in online communities, virtual communities, that perhaps is creating a different type of international culture, I guess we could say, that might one day be a force that actually shapes the national cultures in some way, shape, or form. There's a lot to talk about with regards to that, but in the Japanese example specifically, I would say that this is a country that is largely still under a type of imperial conditioning. I mean, for hundreds of years, these people have been ruled by an emperor, and just because the emperor got nominally kind of dethroned after World War II, it doesn't mean that that mindset or that mentality has fundamentally changed. It's still essentially a feudal society, I would say, and until quite recently has still had things like lifetime employment with the same company, and basically the company tells you where to live and what to do, and you go along with it, and you do it your whole life, and you get taken care of by the company at the end of your life, and that was just kind of the system. And that started to break down in the last 10 or 20 years since the collapse of the bubble here. But I think that's the mindset that has still maintained itself throughout throughout Japanese society, so that there's this idea that you just go along, you do your work as you're asked to do, and you don't ask too many questions, you don't make too many waves, and things will be provided for you. And so far, I suppose, that's kind of worked out for generations of Japanese who have lived through that system and have managed to make their livelihood that way. That is starting to break down now, and of course the youth here are more, I would say, westernized in the sense, in every possible sense, but I think also in the sense that the idea of lifetime employment with the same company and things like this are starting to break down here. So those are things that shape the Japanese mentality. But in terms of the awakening to some of these issues and some of the things that are going on, again, I think that this is something that that has obviously, I mean, been absolutely 100% steroid boosted into the stratosphere by the internet and by online sharing of information. And it's hard to look at it from any other perspective, because I know from my own personal example that it would have been theoretically possible for me to discover the information I did without the internet, but it would have taken decades and decades and decades of going through libraries in different parts of the globe that I just realistically probably would never have done. So from my own perspective, I know that the internet and the access to information that it provides has been absolutely fundamental to the shaping of my own consciousness. And it's difficult to understand exactly how that plays out in each individual person and how we can look at that in terms of its overall societal development. But I think there can be no doubt that looking from 10 years ago to today, the difference is massive. And one of those differences that I mentioned, for example, is even the awareness of the Federal Reserve issue. I mean, the Ron Paul candidacy, whatever you want to say about it, if nothing else, it was an example, I think, of something that couldn't really have existed in the form that it did in the pre-internet era. I think there was so much energy and enthusiasm that came from that internet organizing and sharing of information that's the type of phenomenon, the type of thing, the type of thing that we can look forward to going forward. And I think if things remain in the status quo that they are today, with the relative freedom to share information that we have right now, I think it is inevitable. I think that the fact is that we do have facts. We do have truth on our side. And the other side likes to use conspiracy theory labels and all of that type of thing to try to shut people's minds down to these types of issues. But that only works for so long. And as things like what happens in Cyprus and the Lehman Brothers collapse and all of these things start to wake more and more people and shake them out of their trance, I think it is inevitable that we will start gaining, which is why I think really one of the most fundamental issues is the protection of the internet and the ability to share this information. Because without that, I think that the possibility for future awakening is at the very least greatly dampened.
Speaking of Cyprus, someone just asked in the comments, could the latest events from Cyprus have a trickle-down effect across the euro and U.S. economies? What does the delayed opening mean in Cyprus? Do you think this is going to have a significant impact?
It will, and it obviously will. One of the people involved in the deal made the mistake of using the word template. He said that this was a template for possible future Eurozone crises, and he immediately had to retract that statement. So I think it was Reuters. I can't remember which news agency published that. Maybe it was Bloomberg. But one of them published an interview with him, and he immediately went and retracted it. Oh, I never said that. Because, obviously, the fear is that this is the template that's going to be used, that when and if there's another crisis, rather than even using the ridiculous bailout method that was used in the 2007-2008 collapse, instead of that, where you just basically create this money on the back of the taxpayers and then give it to the banks, you can just literally take it out of the bank depositors' holdings. And that's obviously a scary precedent for a number of reasons. To me, it was amazing that they even floated that idea, let alone that they almost got it implemented in the form they originally tried. I mean, that's pretty amazing. That's pretty galling, actually, in a lot of ways. But it does go to show just how far these economic collapse scenarios can take people and can take society along with it. In terms of the knock-on effect, I mean, again, I think this necessarily has a destabilizing effect on the Eurozone. There's been a little uptick because of the announcement of a deal, but that's just a momentary blip. I think that the ultimate trend for this has to be that people are going to be scrutinizing Italy and Spain and Greece more closely now, and to see if this type of thing will be possible there. And we're seeing other cracks in the Eurozone. We're seeing French banks, for example, with recent reports of some stress there. So this is going to be a dampening effect on the euro, and that does have knock-on effects on the U.S. as well. But the overall point of this, I think, is the kind of psychological effect that it has on depositors, because at the very least, again, it shakes people out of their hypnosis, their trance, because it shows people that, I mean, bank deposits are not pieces of paper sitting in a vault. They are uninsured, untaken care of. They're general liabilities for these banking investment financial structures that can teeter and fall at any moment, sometimes with little or no forewarning. And when and if they do, then perhaps all of those digital ones and zeros you have sitting in your account will just vanish. So at any rate, it does wake people up to that reality, and hopefully will have a destabilizing effect on the system and will encourage people to stop just trusting that their money is safe in a bank and will actually start to think about how they can use their money in different ways. So there can be positive effects to this. I mean, just because we're saying that the euro is destabilizing or collapsing, in some ways that's a good thing. In other ways, since the system is structured around the transfers of these pieces of paper or these notional pieces of paper, it does mean that real human beings will be affected by this, and people are and if that collapse, something that I'm hoping for in that scenario, but I do hope that we will start to think how to transition before that collapse scenario comes, because that's really going to be the key. If we can get ourselves positioned to be ready for this when it comes, then we don't have to go through that that bankster-induced austerity and all of the shenanigans that go along with that.
Do you think this is being used to desensitize? Do you understand what I mean by that? I mean, is it just being thrown out there to see, okay, how much will they take? What exactly, how will they react?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it is an incremental process. They take an inch, they'll take a big step forward, and they'll just see if people go along with it. And of
Can you hear me?
Can you hear me, man?
Yeah, I don't know what has happened.
I think we lost
James.
It was kind of catching in and out, and then it kicked on.
Yeah, I think his internet had a problem.
Yeah.
Darn it! I had a good question for him too.
Yeah.
Oh well, technical difficulties. This is
Google Plus.
Yes, we cannot control these things.
Yeah. Maybe he'll. I wonder if you can kick him out and then invite him back.
Yeah, I probably will. Let me do this real quick. He's probably in the middle of a brilliant speech right now.
He was, but he's going to be like, they just kicked me out.
Actually, I didn't have to kick him out. It looks like he just kicked himself out.
Okay.
He may have just completely lost connection.
Yeah.
Let me see.
Yeah, I wanted to, I was looking forward to hearing that reply.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, well.
James. Shows him on.
And now a word from our sponsors.
I guess I'll play a song. Oh, goodness. It's Fireside Chats after all, right?
Yeah, right.
This is intermission, guys.
Yeah.
Hold your ears. Oh, goodness.
Play away, man.
I've been working on this song. So this is truly, just experimenting on you guys shamelessly. Like, if you survive, we'll see if it's... We'll see how it goes. Let's see. It's not completely finished. And it's actually written in like two places. Like I have part of it on one page. Actually, it's on three different pages. This is probably going to just end up pretty random.
Here we are on this runaway train of time, losing it. As I'm watching this bad night.
Is that James? Is that James back? Or is that you?
Oh, what's that?
No, I thought I heard James come back on me. I guess.
No. Sorry.
Yeah, I should just play it.
Here we are on this one-way train of time, closing in. And as I'm watching this madness unfolding, I'm looking within and I'm wondering, ooh, I'm wondering how we can turn this around. And I'm searching for the fire within. For the fire within. For the searching for the fire. For the fire within. Fire within. Fire within. Seems to me that what we really need is to take this spark and make it a plane, more vertices. I plan to agree that there's always a way. So won't you help me now? Won't you let me turn this around? Oh, won't you take that spark and make it a flame? Make it a flame. Take that spark and make it a flame. Ooh, make it a flame. Won't you take that spark and make it a flame? If you're gonna stand up now, stand down. Well, if you're gonna stand up, you're gonna stand now, stand now. Speak now, whatever won't you be, cause this is where it all goes down, right here and now, right here and now. Oh, oh. Train of time, closing in.
Is that James coming back there?
It is. Good job, man.
We decided to make it a real campfire while you were.
Yeah, we had a little intermission.
Well, I hope that doesn't happen again.
Well, this is why I was telling you we have to keep the Skype chat open. It does happen.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
It's Google Plus, and that's why I keep a guitar next to
good song, man. I want to make sure that I hear his last response to that question. We were talking about Cyprus, and I brought up the whether it was somebody fishing.
Right. I don't know where I got cut off.
Right at the beginning.
Oh,
you were.
Yeah, that's too bad, because I'm telling you, it was the best response I've given yet.
That's what we were saying, man.
Oh, well. My basic point was that this is clearly a testing of the water. It is a psychological stressing event that is just one in a series, and I think we have to see this as a process of taking a little bit and taking a little bit and then making a big, bold move and seeing if people will go along with it. Because there comes a point at which people will go along with big events like that when they have been psychologically conditioned through enough stresses to accept it. And I point back to the experiments of psychologists like Martin Seligman, who studied the process of learned helplessness, where people can be learn to be, or be conditioned at any rate, to basically accept the fact that nothing that they do can change the system, that they're just going to be, they're going to be stressed from time to time, so there's nothing they can do, so the people just give up trying. And this is an interesting phenomenon. So for people who aren't familiar with his experiments, I don't know in great detail, it's been a while since I studied them, but it was basically around the idea that he conditioned dogs through electrical shocks. Basically, he would put them on a floor surface that could be charged so that the dogs would be shocked. And they were penned in through walls and structures so that they couldn't escape these shocks. And they would be shocked randomly, and then they would just, they'd get the shock and they'd go crazy, but there's nothing that they could do about it. And he found that eventually these dogs could be conditioned so that even if the barriers were lowered, so that the dogs could easily jump out of the area if they wanted to, they had been so conditioned by these shocks that eventually they would just lie down and take them. And even when the barriers were lowered and they could jump out, they wouldn't even try to do it. And that's an interesting phenomenon, and I think it does apply to the human condition as well. I mean, I think people can be conditioned by psychological stresses that there's nothing they can do. And to a certain extent, I think that's one of the insidious parts of the entire democratic system, because that system basically tries to tell you that, oh, well, you have a say. Every 4 years, you can push a button on a screen or pull a lever or whatever it is, and you can vote for a candidate. And it doesn't matter what candidate gets in. I mean, it can be a Bush or an Obama, and they're going to do the exact same things, and the economy's still going to go to hell, the wars are still going to happen, torture, secret arrests, imprisonment, drones, all of the craziness can continue. And what part of what that does is condition people that there's nothing you can do. Just lie down and take it. And I think a lot of people do get to that point eventually. And I think as opposed to that point, what we have to stress is that there are things that you can do, but it involves a completely different method and strategy than what we've been presented with. So that's, I mean, that's a pretty big take from the Cyprus situation, but I think that is part of that, what leads into that.
No, I think it's, I mean, I'm in total agreement with you. I think it's absolutely just seeing exactly how far they can push certain, you know, certain events. And it's an interesting, it's interesting timing and how it's brought up in the news. It's kind of brought up underneath. And so I was just interested in your take on that. Thanks.
I had a question, because we've been having these discussions and it's
gone. Hey, Charlie, by the way.
Oh, Charlie's in?
Yeah, yep. Charlie's here. Yep.
This is, by the way, guys, this is Charlie McGrath. He's coming in for the second hour. If you aren't subscribed to his channel on YouTube, it's Krabby Dog Tricks. Just let everybody know who all's on this call so far, because we've been kind of rolling with it. We've got Kevin Rose, which is Grounded Being on YouTube. You can find his website, groundedbeing.net. We've got James Corbett, the Corbett Report on YouTube. And we have Charlie McGrath, Krabby Dog Tricks, Storm Clouds Gathering on YouTube and on Facebook and all that. Good to have you on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Sorry I can't make the first hour. I told you in exchanging through Skype there that I'd do my best to join the second hour, but I just finished up. And hello to and hi, guys. James, I just answered you a Skype message. We've been playing contact through there. And I just caught the tail end of what you were saying about Cyprus. And, you know, I couldn't agree more with at least what I heard. I'm sure that we have the same opinion on this. Absolutely shocking development. Over the last couple of days there, the outright theft of money out of people's accounts is, you know, it's bad enough that the people actually had to vote on such a measure, the 6-10% haircut. But when they rejected that and they just decided they'd just go ahead and do it, and then to have this president of the Board of Governors of the ESM not only condone it, engineer it, but then come out and say this will be the model going forward to save failed banking institutions. It's incredible, and it's terrifying, to be honest.
I had a question about this whole thing. I mean, I think from what I've gathered, most of us see this as going.
From what you storm cloud gathered. Sorry.
What's that?
From what you storm cloud gathered.
Oh, yeah. Cha-ching. I need to have that sound.
Yeah, I was just trying to get the Google effects up real quick.
Man. Well, I decided that I'm going to have fun The last time I was on, it was pretty heated for a while. So,
yeah, we're trying to change the. By the way, just a point of reference for people. That was the wrong timing.
Sorry, man.
And so it degenerates.
Timing is awesome. That's great.
Oh goodness. Yeah. Well, my general thought on things is if something's not working, adjust and adjust quickly. So. This format is pretty new. You know, Google Plus has only been allowing live streaming on the YouTube channels for a short period of time, and I've had the ability for a while, and I've just been resistant to it because it's, perfectly honest, it's been intimidating because you don't know what's going to happen, and you know, as the case in the last time we had the conversation, it can get heated, and suddenly it's like not exactly the.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was still interesting, and there's a lot of different point of views, but, you know, when you have a lot of strong opinions gathered, and, you know what, we had a bunch of people there. I think it was eight or nine people in that lineup, so, but, you know what, that's the way it is. People deserve to have and should have their opinions, and some people are excellent in sharing them. Some people, you know, cha-ching.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Okay. So back we had that pun. Am I right in assuming most of or everybody in this chat sees that this is headed towards a one world currency and pushing towards a one world kind of government type scenario in the long run? Is that the correct perception? That's my assumption.
From here.
If there was any other way of looking at it, I'd be interested to hear about it, but I can't imagine how else it would play out.
You know, it was. That's my crabby dog tricks right there, Mark. Jean-Claude Trichet said several years ago, you know, financial global governance is necessary. You know, he was the head of the ECB at that time. Now he's sitting as the chairman of the European Trilateral Commission. You know, the head of the ESM is saying this is what they're going to do and implement at least governance global or financial governance over Europe. You would have to be completely naive to have your head out of the pop culture infotainment and not see what's happening and describe it as a push towards global financial governance, which is whatever anybody says, regardless of what your belief system is on commerce, as we were talking about on the last time we were all together. Financial governance is government. If you control global finances, you control the globe.
Yeah, I agree with that. Do you think it's going to work? And if it does, then how long do you think it'll last? What are your thoughts?
Who's that to?
It's to anybody.
Well, let's put it this way. I mean, I think that there a lot of people like to dismiss the idea of the new world order. They like to say, oh, it's just the old world order. But I think there is a difference. I think that we are living in a technologically advanced society where the idea for technological tyranny is now so advanced that when and if they get that global financial architecture instituted with the technology of, for example, the ability to completely track, trace, and control every transaction that takes place in that global economy, something that literally would never have even been feasible, it wouldn't have even been thinkable before, now is truly possible with the types of technology that we have. That should be scary to anyone who understands what control comes from that level of technology. So that I think we have to be wary of even the attainment of this goal, because it's difficult to imagine how you can resist against that system once it has been put in place, because the entire system is built around having 100% control over people, the ability to literally turn on and off your ability to sell in the economy or to transact with other people, or the ability to do anything anonymously. So I think we have to be wary of this coming into being in the first place, because I think that that's really the big hurdle on their side. And from that point, with the drones and all of the other technology that they have to back it up with physical force, if the economic force doesn't work, I think we are in a very scary scenario at that point. So I think that the most important thing we can be doing right now is building up the alternatives right now before it gets to even close to that point, so that we have something that we can transition off towards and completely not necessarily derail what they're doing, but just completely shunt ourselves onto another track to avoid completely where they're trying to take us.
It seems like we're already there. It's just we don't have the whatever you want to call it, the New World Order, they just don't have their jerseys yet. You know, I mean, it seems like we're already with the monetary system and the military system and the just everything together. For my estimation, there's no delineation between any of it. And that to me is the disturbing part. Now it's just kind of, it seems how to introduce it.
Yeah. It's almost like they're building up to the,
yeah,
the opening up the curtains and saying, ta-da.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
But I mean, one thought, you know, we've been seeing the events that have just been going at just breakneck speed in the last couple of years, and especially this last year. It's just incredible the kind of things that they're rolling out. I mean, previously this would, you know, the kind of things that have just happened in this past 6 months would usually take 6 years. And the result has been just a mass awakening. If you just look at how the public is, you know, opening their eyes to this, makes me wonder if just the schedule is just so completely off at this point. I mean, whether they're behind or whether they just tried to cram too much into one time or something, whether this could just really accelerate the awakening to a point where they just completely lose control of even the old school methods of control. I mean, what are you guys' thoughts on that?
If you're looking at the, just real quick, if you're looking at the monetary system, I mean, $700+ trillion in derivatives, what is that? So when you get numbers that big, where do you have to go next? I mean, you have to do something. There has to be some explanation, or does there? Can you just make it continue to flow into more and more and more?
Well, no, well, I assume it's going to go, they're going to start collapse it and it's going to go to a new currency, but I'm talking about just whether that.
Well, really, I would like to get I really do value James's opinion on this, especially after talking to him on the program, because I, you know, and living in Japan, where, you know, their sovereign debt is 270% of GDP. But, you know, I think something that happened, you know, I don't think enough attention is being paid to what just happened in Cyprus. Because, I mean, it's one thing to make your nation 271% of GDP in debt, right? Because even though that's stealing sovereignty and it's stealing your future, it's stealing your financial future, and there is going to be pain that comes with that in this current system. But in the here and in the now, it almost feels like recovery. And we can testify to that here in America, right? We went from $9 trillion to $17 trillion in debt, and it kind of feels like recovery because the Dow Jones at 15,000 points. But what happened, and like I said, just glanced over by the mainstream and even independent media is, you know, they're paying attention to it, obviously. But I don't think that we give enough weight to this event. They're now saying that they're not only going to continue with the practice of dumping debt loads onto the people of the world, they're going to take real assets right now. This is not something that they're waiting on. They're not waiting to steal or enslave you with debt in the future tense. They're doing it now. And, you know, does this mean, in one way, it could possibly mean that we're on the fast track to this collapse, because you can't do this kind of thing, even with air quote, I don't even like this term, but even with sheeple, right, that are plugged in to infotainment pop culture. When you start taking their money directly, you are going to cause a collapse. I don't see how you could wake up in Europe today or Britain even, even in Russia with all this exposure and think to yourself, my money's safe in my bank. I mean, this inevitably is going to push Europe to a point of collapse, I would think. And with the interconnection of the web of debt, you know, JP Morgan holding as much derivative exposure as the entire global, more than the entire global GDP, it almost seems as if this could definitely be a trigger event.
I agree, and I think that this has to be seen as that shot across the bow, because even the nominal reasons that they give for this move and what led up to it and all of this, and sort of the idea that they're punishing the Russian oligarchs and all of this is smokescreen, because the London branches of the Bank of Cyprus and Laiki Bank remained open during this entire time and didn't put any withdrawal limits on. So the idea is that the Russians have been secretly taking all their money out the back door through London anyway for the last week. So it's even doubtful that they even have very much money left in those banks, even though the banks have been closed. So, I mean, all of this about punishing the Russian oligarchs and all of this, I think it's just smokescreen. Fundamentally, what this is that pushing of the envelope and seeing if they can get that precedent put into place, because I think the ultimate prize is going to be, for example, the 401ks in the U.S. I mean, once the precedent's there and, hey, we're in a time of crisis, we all got to pull together and we're just going to take 5% off the top. It doesn't matter. We'll get it back eventually.
Or we'll take it all and we'll put a voucher in its place. You know,
More likely. Really. No, exactly. I think that's what this is about. This is about the setting of the precedent, and I think you're right. I mean, I think we have to see it in those terms. But again, I mean, the solution to this isn't going to be, I think, some sort of trying to recapture the old system that we remember from before all this collapse craziness happened, because that in itself was an illusion. I think we have to go back to the roots and see what really is the type of productive economy we want to put together and how that can be facilitated without need for governments, which are controlled by the banksters in the first place. I mean, I think we have to start looking at how we can organize ourselves rather than looking towards that outside force to come and organize it for us through the point of the barrel of a gun.
And does it just have to start at the community level? I mean, does it just have to start that organically?
Well, I mean, we are in the online age. There are things like virtual currencies like Bitcoin, which can be one type of system for organizing that. But again, I'm not a big proponent of putting all eggs in one basket, whatever that system is. So I think that there should be local community action. I think there should be online action. I think there should be ways for communities to come together physically as well, in some types of, you know, greater unions of community currencies and things like that. But I mean, there's lots of different ways to organize it, but I think we have to get out of the way of thinking that it has to be done through government auspices.
And you know, your point is you don't like the one system, like a Bitcoin or something. And I couldn't agree with that more. And the last time on the program, on my program, you know, I really started to think about your suggestion that, you know, the competitive currencies is the way to go. It really struck home with me, because I do believe you're right. That is the answer. One currency, even if it's created directly out of this meeting here tonight, is tantamount to global financial governance. I mean, if you have all that power consolidated in one entity, one currency, one unit of trade, it's a very, very dangerous thing. And it seems like, you know, these units of currencies or these units of trade inevitably throughout history have, you know, pyramided out to a point of this ultimate control and power on that currency, be it the pound or whatever. And then, you know, wars are fought over it, and it's almost like a redo, a restart. So, I agree with you that more is better in this case. More, especially a realization that growth for growth's sake is dead. I mean, it's not going to work. We can't keep building 9 Manhattans a year in China just for the sake of growth. So a complete rethink and variety, I think, is certainly a way forward that would be successful. Best chance, anyway.
It's interesting to me that from the last show that we had, the interesting show with all the aspects of people talking about how to set up the monetary system, it seems like we get caught in the philosophical explanation. And we get stymied by that. We actually hit a wall with that. So how do we progress in that discussion and jump over all of the philosophical discussion of this system or that system? Is that possible?
Well, what is money? Sorry. The question of what is money or what is currency? What is...
Yeah, and I think that's all of it. You know, I think it's from the discussion that we had on this show, and everyone's arguing about what is this, what is that. You know, is it possible to get past that hurdle about, you know, defining it? in order to get something started, or more somethings started.
Can I reframe that question a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely, man.
You cannot.
No, my goodness.
Where are my sound bites when you jump in like that?
And this brings me to exactly what I was going to say, which is the social aspect. I think that's a huge aspect here. Because what I've been seeing is that getting people to where they can even agree to disagree or to have discussions. I mean, that's the reason I've been trying to get, the entire reason I'm having these discussions here. And, you know, we've had to start with, you know, we started with some extremes and now we're moving down to, okay, a level of, you know, we're all pretty much on the same frequency. So this is a fairly easy conversation. But what I've been seeing is that one of the biggest obstacles that we face is that people don't know how to get along just on just the basic level. Like, you know, liberals separate themselves from conservatives. And when they come in contact with them online, it's like a poo slinging fest in the comments. And just even bringing them into a chat to try to discuss things, it can really easily get out of hand. And to me, it seems like that's this really, really probably the most important factor. Because if, like, for instance, I don't necessarily agree with philosophically with anybody, probably. I mean, everybody has their own ideas. The question is, can you get to where people can know where to set that dividing line and, you know, where to say, okay, well, you can do whatever you want. I think it brings us back to one of those initial questions, the question of the non-aggression principle, which is that, you know, you don't use force to push people into a unified system. And the reason, and that kind of segues into a underlying question, and I'd like to get everybody just to give their thoughts on it, and the concept of, you know, if you are going to restructure this system after it collapses, and given there's going to be a lot of chaos and all these things that we can't predict, how do you approach constitutions, social structures? What are your thoughts on the way that you deal with people who just don't want to live under the same kinds of system, who are within a geographical region that was historically, or for, you know, a couple hundred years, controlled by a single system underneath a constitution which they say has power over you, even though you didn't sign it. What are your thoughts on the constitutions and valid contracts?
Well, maybe I'll go first because that's particularly easy for me. As an anarchist, I mean, basically I adhere to the non-aggression principle, but other than that, I don't think that I have any right to say what other people should do or how they should do it. So if people want to voluntarily agree to contract with me under the terms that we agree upon, awesome. If not, well then, well, we don't have a deal. And that to me is the only viable basis for this type of a system, because everyone loves a system that operates through force and violence when they have the gun. But when the gun is pointed against them, suddenly it becomes an oppressor. And until people understand that it is the gun itself and the threat of the use of that gun, no matter who is wielding it or how or for what purpose, until people realize that is the fundamental problem, I don't think we will ever be able to get along. And until people realize that when that gun is removed and suddenly people are able to freely interact, then it does become a point about, well, then how do I get along with other people and how can I make them want to interact with me? And it actually incentivizes that type of productive activity. So for my own purpose, I would say that I'm not looking to create a system or a type of government or a type of control. I'm trying to get that gun out of the room so that people can actually start having the conversation without looking to mama or papa government to fix everything for them.
How do you deal with the rules of engagement then? I mean, when you, for instance, if you're talking about having, this brings us into some of those philosophical questions, and you know, grounded being, you were saying, you know, how do we get past that? But at the same time, how do you avoid that? I mean, for instance, if you're talking about setting up a financial system or monetary system, and somebody breaks the rules and they start counterfeiting, or you know, say for instance, you're living in a non-aggressive society, and somebody starts initiating violence. I mean, to me, this brings this kind of, this uncomfortable question for anarchists, which is, how do you deal with people who aren't operating ethically? And how do you set up rules for society, basic guidelines like, you know, you don't rape, you don't kill, and then deal with those things in a consistent manner without that being coercive?
Are you going back to? I want to just jump in because although you know we got into this a little bit last time, and maybe fortunately you know we didn't have to get too deep into it because there were so many points of views on it. And I'm more inclined with the philosophy of the question you just posed, which is, you know what, I love the notion of, you know, laissez-faire, leave me alone, do your own thing, I'll do my own thing. But I guess I haven't, maybe I just haven't thought about it as deeply as others. But, human nature is human nature. And I got stopped at this point last time we were on here because I said throughout history, and then someone said recorded history, and I'm like, well, okay. Throughout recorded history, human nature has proven to be one thing, which is there's going to be people who are opportunists, and without some form of you can't even say guidelines if you're not going to have some form of governance, some form of agreement that is made that that has teeth at somehow. You know, we could be trading in our wampum or our tally sticks or whatever in this region, and you know, I think the notion again. To Corbett's point on multiple currencies, multiple means of exchange. If somebody pollutes it by counterfeiting or whatever, who cares? If you have multiple forms of currency, multiple forms of trade, that one quickly becomes known as irrelevant, and you move on to the next one. It's a whole different thing, in my opinion anyway, when you're talking about rape, murder, pillage, theft, that kind of thing. You can't just say, who cares to that? I'll defend myself and not worry about my neighbor. To me, anything that is done outside or anything that is done in a collective at all to protect the society as a whole is governance of some form. Am I off base here?
I understand what you're saying. I would say that when it comes to, I think you're saying that in that case, for example, if there's a rape or something that happens to some neighbor or someone that's not you, then you can just mind your own business and go on with it. I would say that fundamentally in that system, the rights that you have are transferable to other people. So if you have the right to self-defense, you are also able to transfer that right to someone else to defend you. So that is one possible idea of what self-defense would look like in an anarchistic society where it is now. What we do is we somehow magically create the right to do things for these government agents that normal human beings don't have. So somehow you and I don't have the right to lock each other up and point guns at each other and do all of this, but people wearing badges and hats do. Right has been magically created out of thin air by some sort of social contract or whatever magic thinking people have. But I think that fundamentally, if you have the right to self-defense, you have the right to transfer that. If you have people that will take care of you in that sense, then that will happen as well. And I think that that the idea of ostracism from the community should not be undervalued as a way of looking at how we deal with problems. But fundamentally, I want to stress that fundamentally, the argument that I'm making here is not an argument from effect. I am not saying it's going to be utopia. I'm not saying that people are not going to break rules. I'm not saying that bad things are going to happen to good people. They are. They always will. I am not a utopianist. I do not think that will ever be resolved. But to me, this is an argument to do with the base morality of the system involved. And the idea that I will never have to, even tacitly or even sort of by third-party consent, take part in the killing of a million Iraqis or whatever it is, that sort of system would not be possible in a system of voluntary association. That type of event could occur, but I wouldn't be forced to take part in that or to have, some sort of implicit consent to that type of thing taking place.
Would your thought be, I agree with you. And honestly, you gave the best anarchist perspective, right there that I probably one of the best I've ever heard. Stephen Malino, he's been on the program a few times and you know, he does as well, but if you step to a little broader picture, what do you do? And I'm not asking this to stump you. I'm asking this because I'm very curious. I agree with almost a common law theme. There is no law that is given from one man to another or gives them rule or power over another individual. It's almost a common law, you know, whatever you want to call it, by nature, by your creator, you know, which is the golden rule you know, you don't do on others what you have done to yourself, and you can do what you long as what you like, as long as it doesn't harm another person. But how does the anarchist perspective attack? That, whoops, maybe that's the wrong word. How does the anarchist perspective deal with if you had a group, let's say a community that attacked another community? Is there a need for arms? A coalition of a community in an army type of a scenario, or an army type or a force type scenario, where you just need to defend the common law? And if you're going to have that, is it every man is responsible, to be ready to serve in this way? Or do you have constructed military, constructive enforcement of societal rules? I certainly agree with you that bastardized is government as we have it now, to the point that everything is illegal and permits are required to breathe, and there's nothing you can do without having an authoritarian figure standing over you, is beyond totalitarian, and it is the state that we find ourselves in. So I agree with the concept of what you're saying, but my bigger question would be, what do you do to protect this society? And do you have a structured governance of sort?
I suppose you'd have to define society, because we've been conditioned our entire lives to think of ourselves as a community structure that's defined by arbitrarily drawn lines on a map. I think what our consciousness, even how we would perceive our identity in a truly free society, would be quite different. So I'm not sure exactly what type of community we would have to be invaded by another community. I mean, I think that type of, but I understand what you're saying. I think still the idea comes down to the right for collective self-defense. And again, if you have the natural law right to defend yourself, then obviously if you have that in the collective scenario, then you would have the ability to agree to voluntarily create the systems of defense that would be needed. So it could certainly be the case that you would develop something akin to the military system that we have now. I mean, that could be feasibly possible if enough people agreed that, oh, we need this type of defense. But again, it would be a system of agreement, and it would be a system that people could opt out of. So again, I'm certainly not here to say that I know exactly what a free society is going to look like. I certainly don't, and I wouldn't trust me to be the planner and ruler of the world by any means. But that's exactly the point.
And hopefully, you don't think I'm calling you out on anarchism or anything like that. These are fundamental questions that I've had.
To be fair, there's a lot of questions that I have too. How will this work? What would it look like? What would be the best way to set this up? And that's something that I'm trying to explore through my work. And something that I'm going to be looking at in the near future is the concept of anarchy and law and what that would look like. So I'm going to have some legal professors and people like that on to talk about that, because a lot of people have been doing work on this for decades and have, you know, done a lot of work on this already. And I think it's important for us to start exploring this.
Very intriguing, and I would be the first to sign on board if you know, I mean, toiling for fiat money for a life, you know, that is one paycheck to another, or one bill paying to another, all for the want of feeding a beast, is beyond ridiculous to me, and it's not a future. So I think Aaron, this dialogue is open minds. Right, nobody's locked in a dogma, no doubt about it, and I think this is how discussions are fruitful.
But that's exactly what I want it to be. I wanted to bring it back, because I'd framed this question, I'd said it, but I don't think it was quite clear, because what I was trying to get at there, which is what James kind of got to, because he's talking about anarchy with laws. We have right now in the United States, in most countries, they have a constitution. I mean, it doesn't really mean much in a lot of countries. In the United States, it's just essentially been converted to toilet paper. But a lot of people just take for granted that these people 200 years ago wrote this piece of paper, and they signed their names on it, and then that gave them the power to create this federal government, which then has the power to tax and to use violence and all these different things. And people talk about the social contract, and, you know, liberals like to use that in order to say that everybody should, give their portion of their income and throw that back at conservatives. And conservatives, they kind of reject this whole idea of social contract. At the same time, they'll say, well, the Constitution says this. But they're really both saying the same thing, which is that someone else can sign a contract for you, and you just being born binds you to it. And this whole concept of a constitution needing to be a valid contract, where the terms need to be explicitly stated, everyone needs to be aware of the terms, and they need to make the choice, not just by being born, but actually sitting down, however that's done. I mean, I guess you could do it as an online form, you know, when you turn 18 in a modern age, but that it would have to be an informed consent decision. And that that would be the way that a society, the rules of engagement for a society were established, that a society says, okay, well, we're four of us here in this room. We can decide what the rules of engagement are for us, say if we lived in a small community, if we had our families and all that such. And then people come in from a distance and they say, well, hey, we want to live here too. And we say, okay, well, this is the contract. These are the guidelines that we want to live under. You know, we don't want, you know, child pornography. We don't want you building a nuclear weapon in your hut. These kinds of basic guidelines.
Are we in huts?
I'm assuming so. You know, whatever. If you got it.
I'm in a teepee. I'm in Montana. It's a teepee.
maybe you're in a Venus Project dome or something. I don't know. But in the end, it doesn't really matter because it still comes down to informed consent. What are your thoughts on that?
James, do you want to? I mean, my thought is I'm confused a little bit by the question.
Well, then ask the question. I mean, I guess maybe that's the way to ask it.
I think individual. I think, you know, maybe I'm just simple minded because I honestly think that the root of all evil, the root that is oppressing, is this fantasy of financial gain by a small group, or money in general. I guess, you know, putting value on commodity items that people toil their whole lives for. I think if the structure wasn't the way it has always been throughout history, where you worked for something that was fanciful, you know, and the argument could be made that, you know, tribes throughout history and even today, as somebody pointed out in the last time I was on, you know, they work for the betterment of the community. I think there's some attraction to that, and I think there's something appealing about that. But I think a lot of questions. If we control our own person, our sovereignty, you know, what we do and why we do what we do, you know, this is fundamental, I think, to freedom. If we have that tenet to begin, if we're born into that, we're a free individual, we're a sovereign person. We do it. We do as we please for ourselves. Go ahead.
Define that, though, because, I mean, we're obviously not sovereigns in any system that's ever existed in the United States. I mean, there's always been this concept of a law system that was established underneath the Constitution, which you didn't get to sign.
Right.
I mean, these are kind of fundamental questions to, like, the limits of freedom. Because if you accept the Constitution that someone else created for you, then you're not actually free because you.
Well, my answer to that would kind of be back to the common law thing, that regardless if a piece of paper is written or 51 out of 100 people agree or 99 out of 100 people agree, you know, common law is common law. I am a human being. I am naturally free. So, you know, if you don't have
right.
that and base.
Let's differentiate natural law from common law because those are slightly different as well.
Go ahead.
I just want to say, you know, natural law, exactly, the natural rights that are accrued to you as a human being, whereas common law is the system that's developed as a negotiation of those natural rights over a period of time.
Very good. So I'll use the term natural law. You know, if we don't respect natural law, or if that isn't the base of any document or agreement, whatever, virtual document or physical document, if that isn't the core base foundation of it, then you end up with eventually, you know, it might start out, and there's people that say the Constitution was the purest form of natural law-based governance the world's ever seen. You know, it's very much debatable, but inevitably, if you don't stick to that abiding principle, then guess what? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's communism, socialism, fascism. It all ends up in a colluded, corrupt the system that oppresses the people. And I, you know, to agree with everybody that, or to say that I don't know the answers would be accurate to how to govern society, but I can look and see what inevitably happens under any form of governance that we've seen so far.
I would like to suggest that that suggests something about
humanity,
governance itself.
He just spit out.
Dang it! I wanted to hear that.
Yeah, it happened last time.
Are you still there, James? He's probably in a brilliant speech.
I think I am.
Yeah, he's probably halfway through.
There he is.
There.
It's coming and going.
Hello.
Okay, we can hear you. We can hear you.
Okay. All right.
Can you repeat what you...
And that's why everyone should be an anarchist. I hope you got that. It was the best argument I've ever made.
I just... And that's the secret to everlasting life. brilliant.
Yeah, well, if you... just tune in next time and we'll give you that secret. Only 1995. Oh, goodness. Yeah, these are these fundamental questions, and here's why these conversations are started. We're on this frequency where we can all talk, and these things seem very self-evident within this circle right here. But then bring in someone from the left, and it's radically different trying to have this conversation. Now, what I see needs to happen is that we need to be able to get to the point where we can have this kind of conversation and be able to engage people who are coming from the left and from these other perspectives. And that's a totally different thing. And that's why I keep bringing it back to the social aspect, because, I mean, even myself, it's difficult when you're bringing in people from radically different perspectives. But it seems like that's what we have to do if we're going to be, unifying against our common enemy. If you consider that to be something that we need to do, which it seems to me that we do, but what are your thoughts?
I was reading a report, I don't know, it was this weekend at some point, where in Egypt, I guess there's a lot of vigilante justice going on. The story I read, there was four or five guys that stole a rickshaw, and a crowd gathered around them of 300, beat two of them to death, and the other ones got away. And while I look at that as archaic in a sense, you know, the ability to be governed by what is right and wrong. If you steal this, it's wrong. Now, do I think you should be beat to death? No. But the ostracizing, thank you, that James brought up before. I think that that's a key component. But when we have the discussion, when we think about it, if we go back to the very basis, like it's not acceptable to steal, it's not acceptable to kill. And if we go back to those very basics and start the dialogue from that point, I think we have a starting point.
Well, that's the thing, though. I mean, you can get people to say, yeah, I agree, we shouldn't steal, but then you start having the conversation about taxation, and then you got a fundamentally different discussion. And even though it really isn't a different discussion, the word suddenly makes it different.
Right, but that's the thing. And the word makes the difference, but taxation, it is theft. I mean... I don't believe there's any two ways about it.
I want to kind of get back to that, the original question, because I even wrote down discussion, because you had asked or you had stated that, you know, we have this forum here and maybe I'm sure we don't all agree with each other, but we're not stepping over each other. We're not stuck in some kind of cult over our ism. But, you know, and I agree with that 100%, that principle. And that's probably as deep as I've gotten into forms of governance as far as trying to affect change from my point of view that I think I could accomplish. And it's been the whole entire goal of the Krabby Dog Six Channel, the Wide Awake News, was not to suggest that we need to be A or B or this form of governance or non-governance, but it is to show that there is a, I consider it to be a diabolical evil force that is working tirelessly to separate points of view, to separate or to crush discussion, to crush the exchange of ideas, or at least to taint any political ideology or theology that's outside of your little pigeonhole, so that you won't listen to what your neighbor or what somebody in Japan or across the world has to say. And you know, to me, that's absolutely key, is to break down that that obvious barrier that exists everywhere. You know, in the United States, it's rampant, right? We you're left, you're right, you're conservative, you're Democrat. But when you talk to people and you listen to what they have to say and they listen to what you have to say, you realize that you're not that far apart. You know, again, you might have different theology, you might have different ideology, but when I've talked to people that are considered to be conservative or Tea Party or liberal or Occupy, you know what? When you break it down and you talk to them and you listen to them, it usually tends to be they're more, even if they don't admit it, they're more in tune with the natural law or the natural aspect or self-governance than they are, you know, so they're more in common than they do to more reason to be, have a common dialogue rather than to be opposed to one another. That makes sense.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And let me just say, I personally have never, to my knowledge, interacted with a billionaire or a central banker. So I think pretty much everyone I've ever met in my life has been someone who's been roughly in the same situation I am, maybe, you know, higher up that ladder or lower down, but still on that ladder at some point. So we have so much more in common than we ever would with people that are, you know, puppeteering the system as it exists now. So I think that that's something to keep in mind, that it really is an incredibly effective strategy to try to create divisions and to pry people apart based on petty differences, rather than to allow people to interact without those barriers, without those veils and filters. Agreed. That people put up because of ideology.
Agreed. And no better example could be even in the independent, whatever, independent media truth movement, whatever you want to call it, the dogmas that people hold. I mean, we saw an example of it. I keep bashing the last time I was on here, but we saw examples of that, you know, and James, I'm sure you get people on your program that you think when you get off the air with them that, come on, man, this isn't, you're locked in. If you're locked into whatever your position is, if you're that rigid that nobody else can exist outside of that position, then you're exactly what we have now, right? You're trying to be totalitarianism. A totalitarianist individual that is trying to impose your will, regardless of how right you feel about it.
Well, that's the tricky thing, is that we have all of these ideological tribes, which are really the group identity. And I brought this up in a recent video. I don't know if you guys watched it, but the chain of identity, where I talked about how historically we came into existence. We've evolved for so many years, you know, 190,000 years of human existence.
That's recorded.
No, that was before. That was before recording.
I know. I just I've been waiting all night to say that. Yeah, recorded history.
Oh yeah. I guess. I had the thing for the little rim shot thing. Kevin, you're not doing your job.
I know, man. I dropped. But listen, I've had heavy restraint this whole time, so you should.
I'm sorry. I laughed for 2 days after that because of like.
The later reaction.
Right.
I can't go back to the dinosaur. Okay. That was for James. That was for his speech that we didn't get to hear.
Yeah. We need to keep our mice ready just to click at any moment. Just like a sharp. What do you call them? Old in the Wild West. It's kind of what we're
right.
So yeah, but I bring it back to this concept of the tribe, because I've been thinking about it a lot, and everything I see in human societies is that people are looking for their tribe, and they don't find it in the way that society is organized right now. No, they look for it in other places, and when they find that place where they feel like they belong, and usually it's, you know, an ideology, a religion, or philosophy, whatever it is, if it fills that hole in them where they feel like they belong to something, it completes their sense of identity. Then, if anything is presented which challenges that ideological tribe, then it's a threat to themselves because they've self-identified with it. And I think that's a big factor in this that you really just can't get away from.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to get people to see that because no one will admit that they're attached to a dogma. I've never met anybody who says, you know what, I'm dogmatic. I don't think rationally. I don't look at reality. You're absolutely right.
Well, I think it goes back to I guess I'm kind of dogmatic when it comes to natural law. I mean, I don't think there's anything above it. I don't think there's anything below it. I think it is what it is, regardless if you believe in it or not, it's there. But, you know, anything pretty much outside of natural law, not pretty much, anything outside of that is somebody else's will opposed onto another human being.
And what is natural law? Can you elaborate a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, natural law would be, you know, depending on what you believe, is, you know, from your divine creator or from nature itself, these are rights that are not given to you. They're just rights that are in being, in nature. You have the right to live, to right to, some of the inalienable rights that are in the Constitution are derived off natural law, pursuit of happiness, the right to the golden rule that could be linked back to Judeo-Christian beliefs that you do unto others as you'd have done to yourself. You do as you wish, as long as it doesn't hurt another human being. In my opinion, this is natural law, and it's that basic. It doesn't need to be volumes of written governance. It is very, very simple. James, would you agree with that concept or take it deeper?
Did we lose James?
Oh, he's not in the queue here.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, I think we lost him.
Time to hurt your ears again. I'm just kidding.
I mean,
well, I agree with you, Charlie. I mean, I think everything really comes back to that. And again, this is what we've talked about the whole time is the non-aggression principle. And that thought process encompasses that particular approach, the non-aggression principle, that violence in itself God, I've lost my mind this evening. Violence in itself is inherently irrelevant. That's not the word I'm trying to say. Aaron, help me.
The initiation of violence is
And so, you know, and you also have the right to defend yourself, and that's really the bottom line. If we all work from that perspective, I mean, imagine what could be changed. And as that flow starts, it also influences the masses, as you said many times, Aaron. You know, you get 10% going that way, and the rest of the crowd will follow.
Well, here's the thing I wanted to bring up here, because when you're talking, for instance, you say natural law. You know, if you talk to, say, for instance, if you listen to Peter Joseph, he'll frame the entire natural law thing completely differently, completely like black and white different, and like. And I say this because
can you give examples of that, Aaron? I mean,
I know that, and this is why I want to be moving these conversations to eventually to start integrating in. I think those earlier chats that we had, it moved a little bit too fast. Tried to throw everybody in together, and it was just like it was chaotic, and weren't able to get onto the same page. But like, say for instance, I subscribe to his channel and I listen to his stuff, and I analyze it. And for instance, he put this whole speech at the Zeitgeist Z-Day thing, and where he was putting out this entire analysis against natural rights, which it's like, God, why do you have to do that? And it's just, and you know, the thing is, I was listening to it, and he was all very logical and very precise, and yet at the same time, to me, it seemed out of sync with humans that as I know them.
like more of a drone or hive mentality, collective. I guess I'm just not following.
Well, you should go watch it. It's available. I think it's on what's that? There's a other streaming site that's not.
I'm too dogmatic in my natural law to listen to that gibberish.
But I listen to. Here's the thing that's important, I think, is to learn to listen to these other perspectives and to learn
right.
to
I was kidding, of course.
To count, if you're going to count something.
Oh, goodness.
I just got trolled by. I guess
sorry, man. At least you know who it is. It's trolling you.
I'm really curious. James, did you hear my very brief description of natural law and your take on it?
I didn't, but I could give you my own take, I suppose. I did hear that, yes, you said it's the rights that accrue to us just by the sake of our being in this world, whether that's from the creator or from whatever people believe, natural universe or whatever it is. But I agree. I think that's right. I think that basically that boils down to, in my view, the non-aggression principle, and an adjunct of that is the respect of property rights. But I think that's basically what it boils down to, and everything that's constructed on top of that are interpretations of that and negotiations of that within human society.
Isn't it interesting that anything above that? To include property rights, anything above that base of very simplistic natural law immediately convolutes a conversation. Immediately, you're going to have points of view that counter. And I believe that's why the fundamental nature of natural law is the ability to live at, just because you're born into this universe. You have the right to pursue happiness and apply the golden rule principle as do unto others as you do to yourself, period. That's it. Nothing else added because as soon as you do, obviously there's going to be, again, that takes us right into society, be it tribes or whatever, small communities, large communities. There's always, I believe, going to be, as long as human beings are human beings, some guidance that is accepted by a community, innocuous perhaps, peaceful and loving perhaps, but some form of guidance that is agreed upon in society. But without that fundamental belief that every human being has the right to exist and pursue happiness and whatever they see fit, as long as it doesn't interfere with another human being pursuing their natural rights, if that isn't the base principle, base core, then I feel everything else just falls apart.
I really do wish we had some people who are on the opposite side, because I've been in so many of these discussions. I started the whole naturalrightsfoundation.org thing, and I have the Declaration of Natural Rights. So obviously that is a position that I come from, but I've had so many discussions that I've with these people who don't believe from that perspective. They don't look at it from that perspective.
Can I interrupt real quick and just say that my belief in natural rights makes that completely fine. they can think whatever they want as long as it doesn't interfere with my pursuit of happiness.
The problem is it does, because these people will want to set up a state and then they want to impose that state on you. And so like getting people on the same page is fundamentally important in terms of the non-aggression principle. And I have people who will, aggressively debate against the non-aggression principle.
Right.
And which is surprising to me, because to me it seems just so obvious. But the question I was going to put to you, because this is one thing that when you talk about rights, is natural rights and such, what I've come to realize is that when we talk about rights as if they exist outside in the world, it kind of confuses people who don't even have that concept in their head. But if you think of it in terms of negative rights, which is more like if you have the non-aggression principle as your base point of reference, then it's not a question that you have the right to live, but that no one else has the right to take it from you. They don't have the right to take your life from you. And it's not that you have this something positive, is it that there's a boundary that people can't cross without having consequences, that you have to be willing to enforce those consequences personally and as a community, or else they don't exist at all.
I agree with that. And I don't think that I'd be the first to say that even though I think society needs to be based on this simple natural law that human history, human beings, myself included, have proved throughout history, recorded history, that that without guidelines above that, that you know, it more than likely isn't going to work. Not more than likely, it just isn't going to work. I mean, we can have 100 people that are living in a community that believe in natural law and nothing else, but if you have one group of three or four individuals that band together and decide they're going to be tyrannical or enforce their will and break that common law right of somebody else, then if you don't have a dynamic in that group to protect the natural law, then it isn't going to work. So I'm not as I said as last time I was on, I am not one that doesn't believe in governance. I think that governance is in and of itself a word that comes under scrutiny to the point that it gets in heated debates really quick. You know, governance to me could be as simple as how I control, I don't want to use the wrong words, how I treat my family, you know, how I treat myself. I mean, I have self-governance. So I don't think government or governance is a bad word in itself. I do believe the principle of natural law, something so simple, if that is a foundation, then you can build upon it. But I'm like James, I don't believe in any kind of utopia that there isn't going to be bad people and bad things aren't going to happen. And I do believe that there is an amount of governance that's necessary in order to ensure that basic fundamental natural law.
We have to differentiate between governance and then enforced governance. I mean, there can be structures of communities coming together that's agreed upon by the community, but
sure,
that can be a voluntary system as well. So I think absolutely. I mean, there's lots of different ways that we can think of the word governance, even in government.
Yeah, and I want to think of it the way you just described: self-governance community, self-governance of individuals, but not a forced at the barrel of a gun. I mean, that's tyrannical.
Right. Opt-in systems I have no problem with. Again, it's the question of whether you are simply in a system because you've been born into it and there's nothing you can do about that. I think that there's something fundamentally wrong with that. But guys, I think I'm coming to the end of my time here. It's coming up to noon here in Japan. I'm going to have to get going.
It's coming up to 10 p.m. here, and I agree.
Well, it's been great having you guys on. I really enjoyed this discussion, and I hope I can get you guys on again.
No problem.
Nice talking to you. Good points. You bet.
Right, anytime.
James, I want to say real quick, I did answer you in Skype, so hopefully you got that. Right. I will be gone. I can join you tomorrow, yep, but I'll be gone. I'll be in China.
I'll get back to you on Skype in the next few minutes.
Well, okay. You guys want to give your websites before your websites and your channel and everything and any announcements you want to do before we go?
James, go.
Just want to tell people you can follow me, CorbettReport.com. That's the place to go for all my work, CorbettReport.com.
All right, my YouTube channel is Krabby Dog Tricks, CrabbyDogTrix. My website's wideawakenews.com.
And I'm Kevin?
Grounded Being on YouTube and groundedbeing.net, and same on Grounded Being on Facebook.
And I'm Storm Clouds Gathering, and of course that's Storm Clouds Gathering on YouTube and Storm Clouds Gathering on Facebook. If you want to get updates, if you just caught the end of this, you get the early link if you're on my Facebook. And if you missed the beginning of this broadcast, then you can listen to it. The recorded version will be up shortly. And we're going to try keeping this at Tuesdays, 9 p.m. If you have any questions, then tweet them to me at Collapse Updates. That's my Twitter handle. If you don't know how to do that, then go to Facebook. It's probably easier. Anyway. All right, guys. Well, you guys have
a good
rest of the week, and I will talk to you later.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.